Welcome to the Raptors Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soups. Time to get fired up. Make sure you find the Raptors Show wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe, please, or interview the program. I'm your host, Wim Liu. I'm joined by co-host Blake Murphy. Blake, how you doing, man?
I'm great. What a night in sports. Baseball didn't happen last night. There's no such thing. The NBA did us a favor, and there was not, I mean, Devin Booker went off, but that's about it. The only really NBA relevant thing for this show is Memphis won, so the Raptors get a little bit extra insulation. But my God, the quality of those two Elite Eight games in the women's bracket, Caitlin Clark against LSU, Paige against Juju. We've got an unbelievable Final Four set up now, but two incredible basketball games last night.
Yeah, look, this is obviously what everyone was watching yesterday, and for good reason. I was just locked in front of the TV for 5 hours. Yesterday evening, the first game, Caitlin Clark ultimately beats LSU. It feels disrespectful to Iowa in general, but it's Caitlin Clark overcoming last year, avenging the loss to LSU. Caitlin makes 9 threes, has 12 assists, is just absolutely dominant. I think, you know, just seeing how poised she was throughout the entire match, even though there's so much pressure, even though there's so much like emphasis to perform. And I think that's something that Holly Rowe, the reporter, was giving the scoop about, like, you know, everyone else sort of like feels and understands this. And Caitlin even acknowledges that, like, there's this big desire to perform and there's a big expectation, but she actually doesn't get nervous at all, which sounds like it's like one of those, like, basically you've only ever heard like these stories about Kobe and like Michael Jordan, like these like mythologized sort of like, I can't believe they can, you know, they operate in this fashion. But then when you see them play, it's like, yeah, actually, that's actually how Caitlin operates. Like, no concerns, no, like, nothing about being shy, just competed throughout the whole thing.
She opened each half with a ridiculous three of just, exactly, like, statement right away. Oh, if there was any concern that I might be nervous, bang, 25-footer.
Yeah, and I just, it was just an incredible feeling to watch that match. I think, obviously, LSU is a uniquely difficult opponent for them because they have so many bigs, and they're very athletic, and they're able to, you know, really dominate the glass. I mean, actually, when I watched it, I was like, huh, they're doing a decent job on the glass.
Nope.
23 offensive rebounds for LSU. And of course, you know, when you have the possession game tilted to that fashion, you need something spectacular to beat them. And last year, Caitlin had like 30 against them, but this time, 41. Yeah, your thoughts, Blake. It was just such a fun game to watch.
It was an incredible game to watch. Again, the opening each half with a huge three. Mm-hmm. I loved, you know, the toughness that Angel Reese showed coming out of that game with an apparent knee injury at one point, hopping on the bike. She gets back in there and immediately demands a post touch of like, I'm back in this game. Let me get back in this game. Morrow played the whole 40. There were so many really good individual performances like that. But like, the main thing I come away with is Caitlin Clark is an offense unto herself. Like, it's the closest thing to Steph at Steph's peak that we've seen, where her, she had 41 points last night, went 9 of 20 on threes. Even if that hadn't been the case, if she hadn't been quite that good, maybe they put FloJ on her at some point to mix up the matchup or whatever.
We'll talk about that in a second. Yeah.
Like, even if she hadn't been quite that good, the offense gets a good look every time down the floor because of the immense gravity that she has. And, like, she comes, like, 41 with 12 assists is crazy. She produces almost all of the offense via shot or pass. And then, like, I don't know, I don't think they count the, like, secondary assists in college basketball. But if they did, there would be a handful of those as well, because at least two people are focused on Caitlin Clark the entire possession, and that creates all these imbalances around the floor. And this is an Iowa team this year that's better able to take advantage of that than the version last year that lost in this spot.
Yeah, that's a really great point, because obviously this is that big testing game, right? Like, I know they still have to win a few more to ultimately get to their big goal, but at the same time, it's like, you know, the team performance was stronger. Having said that, though, Caitlin Clark created 73 points.
Crazy.
Of the team's 94. Like,
and, like, it's a night after we saw Zach Edey basically do the same thing, but, like, they could not be in more, like, diametrically opposed styles, right? Like,
for sure.
Like, they're the complete two opposite ways to dominate an offense and have an offense run around you. It's really, It's really cool. I don't know. On the LSU side, like, again, the Angel Reese toughness, I know she didn't shoot the ball that well.
She started really well. Yeah. And I felt like, okay, you know what? Because LSU threw that first punch, they were up, and then, or Iowa threw that first punch, and then LSU came back. And a lot of that comeback was just giving the ball to Angel Reese and her being able to use her height, use her skills in the post and score that way. But I don't know. After that knee injury, I just felt like she wasn't as involved in the offense. And then also her touch on, you know, around the glass just wasn't as strong.
Yeah, the touch was tough. Like, LSU shot 39% for the game and 33% on threes. And I know that, like, the threes aren't ever, like, in college ball, you can like, you don't have to keep up in the 3-point race necessarily the way, like, sure, you're going to have to.
I mean,
with
if you got 23 offensive rebounds and you have that many low post scores,
exactly,
then yeah, for sure.
Exactly. But yeah, the fact that, you know, 23 offensive rebounds in part because you shot so poorly when you did get inside and you did get those opportunities is a little tough. And like, look, obviously LSU did a ton of good things. They're an incredibly good team. But at this level, when you're in the Elite Eight and this is punching you to get to the Final Four and like UConn's waiting on the other side and stuff, and South Carolina after that, like, yeah, you have one game where a couple of your, you know, one of your bigs and you know, Williams shot the three really well, but anything inside the paint was nothing. Like, you can't miss the easier ones in at a level like this. And you know, that kind of was it.
That was one half, right? Offensively, I think obviously LSU could have done better, but I think defensively they also could have done way better, because I do feel like, look, the way you would manage this game, I mean, it's really one player with like some good supporting cast, you know, like, not to dismiss the rest of Iowa's team, but like, realistically, LSU has multiple players and multiple options, and you just never felt like you got into the best defensive scheme you possibly could have against Kalen. Not to say you would ever shut down Kalen. She would probably still generate lots of offense. But if you could help hold her to, I don't know, 30-9 rather than like 41-12, that might have been a difference in this game. And obviously the big talking point is just like, I mean, people realized this as the game was going on, but Haley Van Lith was just not able to do much with this whole situation.
She was not. And
she ended up on every meme. I feel really bad for her.
Yeah. Like, and like, you know, I can't do the, I'm not going to do the eye roll as well as Kia did, but yeah, it was an obvious thing. Like, even at the halftime panels and things, like, they needed to mix it up. And like, it's especially tough because, I mean, first of all, you start to feel bad at a certain point when Caitlin Clark is doing that. But also, like, this is a team that knows Caitlin Clark and knows Iowa and had lots of prep for the, like, I would have thought we saw more. Like generally at this at these levels, what we hear coaches say is like, okay, well, at least we're going to mix up the coverages and give them a different look and try to get them out of their comfort zone. Like, we've seen Nick Nurse do that tons of times, right? Where it was like part of the star stopping strategy was like, we're just going to throw a bunch of stuff at them and none of it might, like, maybe none of it works, but maybe seeing different things is going to take you out of your comfort zone or whatever.
We're going to hard double you and trap you and just do everything possible. Like, again, like, this is a good point. If Nick coached LSU last night, this would have been a very different outcome. But
it would have been box and one, but probably like, not even triangle.
The box is around Caitlin, not the one.
it's a triangle and two, but the two people are both on Caitlin.
Honestly,
with LSU's like size and the advantage they had inside, you really could have probably gotten really aggressive on Caitlin on the perimeter and just trusted that you had the size inside to recover and contest and stuff. But look, this is like Caitlin Clark just bends teams that way.
Yeah, I know, but I just feel like, okay, you could have obviously, they finally made that switch with like 5 minutes left in the game. It was like, okay, Flojo, you're going to have to go guard her. And, you know, you saw Angel Reese like really actively, like, you know, almost preemptively coming out and blitzing a couple of times. And you saw like Caitlin, okay, one or two times she's like, okay, I got to adjust to this. And then she figured it out to a certain degree. But it's like, you would have loved to see that better than like 5 minutes left in the game. You know?
And like, if you knew that that's something you were willing to turn to with 5 minutes left and with 10 or 15 minutes left,
right after time, like halftime, you know,
You know, it's not like Caitlin Clark snuck up on you.
No. And I also, the thing that I don't feel bad for Haley about is just offensively, she was just taking some of the shots. She had no rhythm at all. She was just getting cooked all the game on defense. And it's like, at least bring it back on offense. And she just, it's very unfortunate. She was struggling with post-entry passes at one point. It just was a lot.
And they're like, they're a deep team through their start, but like, they only play six players.
Yeah.
So you can't, like, there's not really an option to go away from that. You could have gone away from the assignment, But, like, they're not going to win many games against elite opponents. Like, they're going to beat Iowa, UConn, South Carolina unless Van Lith is having a good – like, they need everyone because every team does this point in the game. What did you think of the other game? I know we got to get the damn Wiki here, but the other one was really fun too with Paige against Juju.
No, the other game was also really fun. I just think for Paige, I think she entered – collegiate basketball was like incredible amounts of hype, and then it kind of like died down a little bit, not even necessarily based on her performance, but you saw it in this game. It's just a complete performance. She scores them all over the court. She has a really, really good sense of sort of how to run and control tempo of the whole game without like holding on to the ball. She's really good at knowing when to be on and off the ball. And again, she just like pops up wherever you want, like baseline out of bounds play, you know, short inbound 10-foot baseline jumper, she'll knock that down. A pull-up three, she'll knock that down. Take it to the rack, she'll do that as well. And then she scraps and competes on the other end too. 10 rebounds, 4 guard. The fact that she really, really likes to play defense too. I thought UConn, like, this is not the stacked UConn teams that we're super used to, right? They're not even the number one seed, but like her and Aaliyah Edwards, just the two of them together gave them such a good structure that even though not the rest of the teammates didn't even step up like that, they competed hard, but they didn't really like contribute as much in the scoring. But those two just in general was able to overcome like what, like we all know the next like collegiate star is going to be Juju.
Yeah, like, of
Juju
course. She's 18 crazy. Still. She's 18, so she took 25 shots in that game. And like, I get it. You shoot 9 of 25. It's not the best stat line, but like they needed every one of those field goal attempts. Right. Like they are already, you know, running a lot, mostly through her and Forbes, but like she is going to be the star of that program. And like, if you were going to pick, you know, with Caitlin and Aaliyah and Angel all going to the WNBA this year, if you were going to pick a team to be the one seed next year right now, probably picking USC because she's phenomenal already. And like, we know how this goes, right? Like on your way to becoming a superstar, most people take a lump at some point. You run up against UConn and you lose in a game where you would have liked to be more efficient. I know she was efficient overall.
Like Caitlin Clark got, with UConn,
exactly.
Know, in the same position.
Yeah. You know, and like I know she got the line a lot, but she'll look at 9 for 25 and like that'll be part of her story next year when she's, again, she's still only 18. She's like a young freshman. Future's very, very, very bright there.
It's crazy how shifted she is, man. Footwork, the way she's able to get to her shots, like, everybody's just off balance when they guard her. That's how you know she's such an amazing offensive player.
Yeah, it's really cool to watch. And my main takeaway from these last couple games is UConn was really underseeded as a 3 seed. Like they're good,
probably,
man.
Yeah. They're also really shorthanded too.
Yeah.
A lot of injuries.
And still they're one of the only teams that is playing 7 players. Instead, like everyone has shortened their rotation so much at this point.
Yeah.
You know what?
Nick Nurse would kill it in women's basketball for sure. all right. We're going to bring in Dan Wyke.
Wednesday, by the way, that starts back up.
There you go. Dan, I know you've been on the line for like 5 minutes, man. Do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I've been listening. I've been enjoying. I do have thoughts. Can I spin this to a little different thing? My big takeaway of yesterday, because I'm negative, generally speaking, is how the NBA and men's college basketball have like totally dropped the ball. Because like it was so fun to watch like actual college stars in like a real meaningful way, like with like there were rivalries, there were, you know, there was history.
Yeah.
I wasn't introduced really to any of these people. I mean, outside of Juju. And you know, like we could be talking about, oh man, like, you know, this is Chet Holmgren and Zach Edey's like third battle.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? There was some version of that. And that was, you know, because obviously like you watch Juju and you're like, that's a pro. Right. Mm-hmm. Like she could go pro tomorrow and she would be fine. But like the rules don't allow for that. And with NIL money and stuff like that, like she is going to be plenty compensated to stay in college. Like, doesn't everybody kind of come out ahead? Because like, think about the excitement that like we're all going to have, you know, for Indiana Fever games next year and stuff like that. We know these stars in a way that, you know, when you compare it to what we look at in this NBA draft and, you know, kind of the men's tournament this year, we're really like, I feel like I'm just sort of being introduced to a lot of these people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a great point because that's what, obviously March Madness, but even the whole entire collegiate season, like it does create this like incredible vehicle to tune in, to watch the product and then get introduced to these people. And, you know, I'm not against like players like getting their bag overseas. We've seen a lot of creative, like basically skip that 1 year, right? We've seen like Darius Bazley like took a New Balance like
internship.
internship.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or like go to Australia.
Brandon
or,
Jennings was kind of the first one to go over. I think he played in Italy.
Right. Like the Ball family is probably the most infamous example of this, where they send LaMelo to like Lithuania, you know what I mean? Or like overtime elite, all these kind of things. And it's like, yeah, sure. I'm sure social media can bridge a lot of this gap, but like, I don't know, man. There is something about like you play in college, you really get known with the program, you grow with it. It does kind of raise your stock quite a bit.
I mean, the women's product is so much better than the men's product.
Sure.
You know, and I think that was really crystallized yesterday. And I mean, that wasn't even the Final Four.
Right.
Those were two Elite Eight games. And I mean, it did sort of break perfectly.
It did.
You know, but that was one of the takeaways for me, in addition to obviously, you know, what you guys talked about and like, you know, how great Caitlin Clark was and, you know, how tough Angel Reese was. And obviously, you know, Paige Beckers and Juju Watkins, just incredible players. But like, I think that was the other thing I kind of was left thinking about, was just sort of like, you know, like it feels like a real sea change in that way, that as college basketball continues to get diluted with like, you know, all of these other pathways and people leaving so early. I mean, you know, if you have a good freshman season, like you don't come back. There's no incentive to come back in you know, college basketball. The money's so big and stuff like that. But like, that's just not how the women's game is. And quite frankly, I kind of think that they're going to be better for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, now that you have NIL, like you can actually kind of do both.
Totally.
You can make a lot of money.
It's also, there's an element here too, where like, because you don't make as much money professionally on the women's side as you do it on the men's side. Yeah. And like, yeah, we all want better salaries for WNBA players and things like that. But the contrast is not as strong, right? The male players can get NIL deals, but a rookie scale contract, if you get picked in the first round, is like a couple million guaranteed. And you can't quite do that. You know, you can't cobble that together with NIL. And I think that, you know, there's not a solution to this. The only way to legislate this kind of thing back into the men's game and not have it just like happen naturally is too anti-labor, right? Like it's too restrictive to player movement and players earning what they could potentially make and things like that. So you don't want to go down that path. So I think we're left to just the NBA and the men's side can try to crib from the momentum and the excitement the women's side has, but short of getting, like, you're not going to be able to incentivize top players to stick around for a couple years. The transfer portal is also like wild on the men's side now as well, where you're tracking, like, I think every team in the Elite Eight had like at least one rotation player they'd picked up in the transfer portal. So I think we're left with, we kind of are just going to have to appreciate the difference. It's a strength and an asset that the women's side is going to have, that the men's side is just they're not going to be able to replicate it. And it's going to be an edge that women's basketball has.
Yeah, I really think that, like, if you're looking at trend lines, right? I mean, like, the trend line for women's college basketball is, you know, going up. For men's, it's, you know, probably going down a little bit. And at some point, they're going to cross, you know? And we'll look, I think, at nights like last night and kind of maybe that is, you know, that's where a chapter of some really well-written book starts someday that I will read and not write.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, it was really fun. And it was a night to sort of ignore the NBA in a way.
So actually, let me pivot to Lakers stuff by asking you this, Dan. How much you're around the Lakers, and we know LeBron is like the basketball fan to end all basketball fans outside of just his own day to day. Is the excitement of Women's March Madness, are you seeing that resonate with NBA players as well? Like, are people, like, obviously you can't be quite locked in because you have games and stuff like that. Is it cutting through to the NBA side as well?
I mean, we've heard LeBron talk a lot about Juju throughout the year, right? Like, I mean, that's someone he knows. I believe she went to Sierra Canyon High School, which is where Bronny went, I think. But so very familiar with her game. You know, we would, you know, probably less March Madness talk this year than in years past. You do usually get a pretty hefty. I mean, like, you know, we had a nice chat with Anthony Davis about Kentucky after they lost. That was fun. That was a fun conversation for me. You know, like, you have those kinds of chats, I think, like, periodically, but like the sort of everybody gathered around the monitors, it hasn't really happened. Now, part of that is just been like sort of the nature of this road trip that they're on, right? Like, we're in city 5 right now of 6. It's been a long trip where I think, you know, we've been gone since the Sunday of March Madness, right? The first Sunday. So since the round of 32. So like it's lost a little bit of that in conversation, but I mean, look, I think there's no doubt that, you know, particularly NBA players, their support of women's basketball has grown and it will continue to grow. And, you know, we like, you know, it's probably worth asking LeBron about the game. And I would bet anything that he probably watched it.
Yeah. Well, it was really funny, by the way, watching along on social media, because that's what you do now. Obviously, you're watching this game, but you're also looking on your phone. And yeah. So much of the people realizing that's like, I saw the sentiment shared quite a bit. I was like, oh, you know, women's basketball has really made it when you essentially have first take versions of hot takes and that sort of like very cynical lens on sports. And I'm like, I suppose that is one way of making it, but like, please, let's make it something different. But in any case,
I saw a good tweet.
Well, I mean, like how good, like, honestly, like, how good is the analysis been in this tournament?
Unbelievable.
Like, really strong, like, you know, like, obviously, like, the shows in the U.S. have been really good. I had a great time watching the Nurses and Cat yesterday. Like that was, like, such a nice treat for me. And I think that is, like, there is – you just kind of sometimes end up talking a little more basketball. I know there've been some veering on that, the like sort of the first takey sort of topics on this stuff. But like, there isn't just a lot of, you know, the reductionary sort of like Caitlin Clark is great, but is it the best performance ever? Like we don't like have like those types of conversations yet about it. I mean, we will eventually, I'm sure. To your point, like one, like, and then
that should be like the standard for making it is like, you know, you get turned into a meme.
Once we start ruining it, I mean, but like eventually, it will eventually get ruined, I'm sure.
Well, somebody who definitely got ruined by this, LeBron. No, I'm kidding. LeBron has more than anyone else been at the very focal point in terms of just people making their whole career about sort of hating LeBron and things like that. Number one question with LeBron right now for a lot of fans in Toronto, is he going to play? Are him and AD going to play tonight? First, let's start there.
Yeah, I mean, they've been listed questionable throughout the season. My hunch would be that LeBron James plays tonight and does not play in Washington tomorrow. That would be kind of the way he would manage the back-to-back because they are they return home and they play three critical home games. They play Cleveland and Minnesota in a back-to-back, and then they play the Warriors.
Oh,
and it is like, if you kind of clear that pathway and LeBron's foot, he's been honest about it. Like, I mean, it's just, it doesn't really seem like a thing he's doing on back-to-back nights, like right now. So my guess is you play today and you buy the extra day rest. That would be my hunch, but they haven't made any formal decisions. It would surprise me if he took the day off. If he did, it's because something in Brooklyn didn't feel quite right. But that was a fairly low impact game. I mean, he didn't look hurt in Brooklyn.
Did he hurt it fading away into the corner for three? Because that's the thing with LeBron is like,
What a bonker shot that was.
Trust me, of all people in Toronto do not need to have that explained. You know what I mean?
No. Because
he just hits that point where he's like, I'm so comfortable. Now I'm just sort of here to test the limits of what I can get away with. And he's done that in playoff series.
He did it the last time he was here. Like so we were looking at the game, trying to refresh ourselves earlier. LeBron's only been here once since the championship season for the Raptors because of the pandemic and injuries and things like that. But yeah, the one game he played here, they won in overtime and he hit a bunch of insane shots. It was like, oh, it's 2018 again. Cool. Great. Yeah. Love it, LeBron. Okay, you mentioned those three pivotal games they have coming up. So after this Raptors Wizards back-to-back, which has to rank among the lightest back-to-backs in league history in terms of like quality of competition at this point in the season.
Yeah,
combined like 2-25 over the last month. Then they have the Cavs, Timberwolves, and Warriors, and this is we're running out of time here. This is a Lakers team that is only a game and a half back of Sacramento now as Sacramento slides because of injuries and things like that. They're also only three out of sixth, which would allow them to get a little bit of extra rest and avoid the play in there. Is that kind of the talking point around the Lakers right now? Is they're trying to get the sixth or is it just get there healthy? Or
I think it's more to eight. I think honestly it's get to seven or eight. Six, I think, just from a tiebreaker standpoint. So they don't have a tiebreaker with the Kings. They really fumbled. They the two games with Sacramento, it's been a horrible matchup for them over the last couple of years. But in particular, the first game, I think they raced out to like something like an 18-point lead and they lost. That was and will be a critical game, as these standings shake out. But like you mentioned, and I mean, you can kind of do the NFL sort of like win-win-loss thing. You know, they've got, let's say you win these two in the back-to-back and you win two of those three at home. You're going to, and then you add in, you end the year with at Memphis, which is not a difficult game. And then you go to New Orleans, which could be a very important game. You split those. So that gets you to 47 wins, right? Like, great. Well, that, that becomes sort of the target number. New Orleans is already at 45 wins, so that doesn't seem like you can catch them, but the Suns, maybe the Kings, maybe, they do have the tiebreaker with the Suns. That's kind of been the goal. It does feel like, guys, that if the season was 86 games, they'd be in a much better position. Mm-hmm. Like, it just kind of feels that way. Like, they,
everyone's always saying the season should be longer and we should have more regular season games.
Yeah, I know. This is a very popular LeBron James thing. He wants more regular season basketball. I have some stats for you guys.
Yeah.
I pulled these up. So, since the Lakers moved Rui Hachimura into the starting lineup on February 3rd, they're 17-8. They have the second best offense in the league. Third best offense in the league behind Boston and Dallas. But they're second in effective field goal percentage, second in true shooting. They are, among the best passing teams in the league. Like, the Hachimura stats, guys, like, is like a Jaron Butler light style role player offensively, have been absurd. Shooting 58.5% from the field.
Yeah.
As a guy who shoots threes and mid-range jumpers, and they figure out ways to get him in the post and mismatches. D'Angelo Russell has been terrific. He's at 41.8% from three during that stretch. Rui's at 44.7. LeBron James, guys, 45.7% from three.
Yeah, well, I think
it's crazy.
Isn't he shooting a career best from three right now in his 21st season?
Yeah, he's been awesome.
Kind of inspirational.
It's I was having a conversation with Darvin Ham the other day about Rui and kind of Rui's sort of emergence as one of their best catch and shoot guys. And I kind of like off-handedly said like, oh, he may be your best catch and shoot guy. And then it's like, well, no, probably D'Angelo Russell. I was like, well, maybe it's LeBron. which was kind of funny that, the conversation turned to like how much time he had left after the Brooklyn game, because I watched the game and I kind of had the opposite thought, which was like, if you're going to shoot like this, why couldn't you do this for another 5 years?
Well, that's the thing that's incredible, is it's like when great players get old, especially players who at the start of their careers relied a lot on athleticism. And obviously LeBron was like an athletic freak, kind of still remains that, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it's like, I remember even 10 years ago, it was like, well, he's got to develop that post game. That's going to help him transition and still pretty productive. And now it's like, he's made a second transition. And it's just like, I'm now an elite high volume 3-point shooter as well. And that's going to carry me for another stretch. And it's like, see a player reinvent twice?
It's really a testament to his work ethic, right? Like, and I think that does get sort of, I mean, he talks about it a lot. And I think, but when we talk about LeBron James and sort of like, the overall sort of story of his career, right? Like, you talk a lot about how blessed he was. I mean, like, he is like a freight train, right? Like, he's gigantic. And we have never really seen a player combine force, size, speed and skill, like all of those things. I guess force is part of speed, but like, combining all three of those factors, we've never seen it. But like, the skill part has continually evolved, and he's changed not only with age, but he's changed to mirror the NBA. The notion of LeBron James being a high volume 40% 3-point shooter would have been absurd 15 years ago. That just wasn't what he did at all. That was the way you stopped him, was you forced him into this stuff. And he said this the other day, like, teams still probably would pick that. But it's funny, it's, watching him these last few years, like, one of like the, I don't want to say sadder things, but like reminders of like mortality, right? Is like, there'll be a moment where he'll get a big switched on to him. And in the past, it's a blowout, mm-hmm. right? Like, he is going to take Ivica Zubac to the rack. right? Now that possession ends with a step back a lot, you know, and that is, I think, both a recognition of like the fastball that he can't always throw, but like the changeup he often develops. I'm staring at Rogers Center, by the way, from my hotel room. So I'm thinking baseball.
Yeah, we should invite you into the studio, honestly. We didn't know that you were in Toronto. Although it's very clear, based on that painting of what looks to be bike racks behind you. Yeah, like that's a very iconic Toronto thing, those circular bike racks.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how we do it here.
Yeah.
Guys, I have a tremendous view of your city today my hotel. And I wish it was sunny, but otherwise it's lovely.
Well, we're going to get to see you down at the I almost said down at the park. This is how you know I'm in baseball mode now. We'll see you down at the arena shortly. Thanks for taking the time out, man. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Anytime for you. There you
go. Dan Wojcie, LA Times.
Yeah.
All around good dude.
All around good dude, man. I'm really excited to chat with him. The last time I saw Dan Wojcie in Toronto at Scotiabank Arena as a fellow member of the media was the finals. And I was working at Sports Canada at the time. Our table was set up right beside LA Times. And all throughout the game, Dan Wojcie was just so chill. Meanwhile, I'm just like, you know me during games.
Yeah, I know you during games. Yep.
I'm like, and it's the NBA finals, man. And he's just sitting there eating a pack of Jolly Ranchers, and he just went through that pack, and he was just not fazed at all. So I do wonder if Dan remembers that as well. So I'll ask him that later on. But before we go to the break, time now for today's spicy take brought to you by new chunky spicy soup. Are you ready to get it fired up?
Yeah, I am. Let's hear it.
This is the take. Honestly, I think we were talking about this in the office earlier today, and the question was brought up, like, you know, do you think LeBron will get a farewell tour and things like that? I think, for, number one, the league, the sponsors, everything will force him to have him do the farewell tour. But, like, I think for me, honestly, and LeBron kind of spoke about this, you know, there's not so much time left. I actually think it'll be a little bit too much to do a farewell tour. I think, like, there should be some special commemorative event by the league.
You,
I don't know what his final game is.
You don't need the Derek Jeter gift basket at every stop kind of thing, though.
Yeah, because I just feel like, you know, there's going to be certain markets and certain games where it's just like, all right, he's playing the Pelicans, and, like, what are they here to give them? Or, like, the Charlotte Hornets. I think the difference here with, like, and it's not a hating LeBron thing. Like, obviously, we clearly very much appreciate LeBron based on what just happened. But, like, the difference with the Kobe one was, like, Kobe has this, like, specific reverence where, like, people and players, most importantly, revered him for sort of what Kobe stood for. It was, especially towards the end, it wasn't just about what he was as a player or what he had done as a player, which you can always objectively, like, debate the, like, actual accolades of what he did, his resume as a player, and you can compare it to other players, and that's why there's so much discourse around where he ranks all time, whatever. But in terms of where he is revered all time, he is much, much higher because, you know, the way he sort of, you know, stood for working hard and sort of that the mama mentality that I think a lot of athletes undeniably have gravitated towards. I think that's the one failure with LeBron's in terms of the marketing. It's just like, he's great. And it's like, he's great because, you know, Kobe somehow turned himself into, like, he worked into becoming this, whereas LeBron felt very much like he was born like this. And that's not fair to LeBron because LeBron put in a ton of work into it.
And also, Kobe was, like, kind of born into it as well.
Kobe was way more born into it. Let's
like
be
legacy basketball family and
even
things like that.
Even the circumstances of how he grew up.
Yeah.
Right. He was in a more, you know, a better.
And like
position.
Again, like with LeBron, that doesn't discredit the work. It's just funny how, like, the story, the way the story has been presented, or like over time has settled in.
Right. So I just think that, like, in terms of reverence, Kobe had it at a higher level, whereas LeBron is just universally respected. Having said that, though, I think he's going to have a farewell tour. And I am going to – it is going to be mad awkward when whoever for the Raptors has to come down and be like, hey, thank you for LeBronto. Here's it's probably going to be Drake.
Here's
honestly,
the ball you spun in our face. Here's the wine you pretended to drink during a playoff game. Look, I don't – the gifts and stuff like that, whatever – I will say, with a player of LeBron's stature, and I would feel this way about Steph as well, I at least
want... Steph is, like, revered.
Right. I'm just saying, sorry, to your point about, like, the farewell tour or whatever, I just want to know if it's the last chance I have to see a guy.
Yes, for sure.
At least that much.
Well, he's going to get one. This is all irrelevant. I just think that there is a slight difference in terms of how it's going to be presented and sort of how they were both marketed at one time. But... hopefully we get to see LeBron tonight at the arena.
Yeah, hopefully. You know? Well, we'll see him. Hopefully he plays. He'll be there. Let's take a break.
Let's do it.
And let's talk about a documentary everyone should see.
Okay. Let's do that. Okay, so I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sportside Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL, the J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Raptors Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Chris Wayne Liu. You'll be joined by co-host Blake Murphy. Blake, who do we got for segment two?
Yeah, we got a pal of mine and a documentarian and director, Jeremy Shaolin Ryu, a multiple-time Juno nominee and director of Handle With Care, the legend of the Nordic streetball crew, now streaming on Apple TV, on YouTube, a bunch of other places. The documentary has been nominated for a bunch of awards. It won awards out at the Vancouver Film Festival. Jeremy, you're killing it, man. Welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. A fan of the show, fan of both your guys' writing. Excited to be here.
Well, welcome. And yeah, so I guess you're a big basketball fan, and this is a... So for anyone who hasn't seen the documentary, go see it, by the way. We were going to play a trailer, but I missed the cue for it, so we're just going now. But obviously... You're a part of this story as well. So the story is about this streetball crew in the Vancouver area, but it's also about you and your co-director Kirk and how you guys got your start doing these like streetball mixtapes. So have you been like lifelong? I know your wife does a WNBA podcast. How much of this story is like about you, or like feels like very, very personal for you given your relationship with basketball as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think the story feels super, super personal to me. I think especially because like the time when we were originally making these mixtapes, when I was kind of, me and Kirk were following around this amazing crew of guys that came to be called the Nautic. It was like 98, 2001. So I'm just finishing high school. This is like my coming of age. It's sort of their coming of age. So I think that like what happens to you around that era sort of defines a lot of who you are as a person. Like I still sort of talk like some of those guys. I try to walk like those guys. Like you can't help but sort of... follow kind of the people you looked up to at that time. So getting to make this documentary 20 years later, I feel like is really sort of like helping my life get knocked into balance. And sort of streetball and basketball, like I Katie makes WNBA podcasts. I met her through basketball. Basketball is like the lifeblood of everything I do in a weird way, even though I'm not kind of in a professional way like you guys.
Yeah, well, first off, I mean, this is something that I didn't fully appreciate and wasn't really aware of sort of the importance of it. Even coming down to the studio today, I was asking Blake, I was like, yo, were mixtapes really that big? Like you guys were just like walking around with DVDs and VHSs.
Like, I think you're 7 years younger than me, but yeah, this is a huge gap of like, if you weren't on it in the late 90s, early 2000s, like And One had a minute. And I think And One inspired a lot of these guys. Right. Uh-huh. But it was a Absolutely. Huge thing. Like And One was like a big brand, right. Like, I had giant baggy shorts, even though I was a hockey player. It was a real cultural thing, man.
And I think that's something that you've done so well in this documentary. Let's actually go to the trailer so people have an understanding of what we're talking about here.
Appreciate it.
Yo, there's a scene in Vancouver, and these dudes are nasty.
Getting hold of the Nautic, it was like gold dust.
It's folklore. You know what I'm saying? Like legendary folklore.
All right. Is it recording yet?
Yeah.
You come from everybody's black to... Yo, Dave, it's just me and you.
I had coaches tell me, you know, don't play this jungle ball. Okay, like, you don't want us to play like black people?
That mixtape, it's spread like wildfire.
Germany, Australia, Japan.
I'm gonna bust some freestyle moves coming down this court because this crowd is rowdy, dog.
We were just streetball rock stars.
This is the family that I never had until I didn't have it anymore, right?
That's kind of why I've had a bad taste in my mouth when it comes to the two of you.
People might say, well, yeah, it's a long time ago, forget what I was in the past, but it really impacted my life.
It was something really different, and we got an incredible childhood out of it.
I feel like I could become something great.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, wow. you get the sense there of the emotion that's packed into this, because it's not just about the streetball. I mean, it's about the relationship between all these players then and through the 20 years. So obviously, look, it's deeply personal to you. You're very, very close to it. But this has resonated with a lot of people. Like, this is not a documentary for a small segment of Vancouver basketball fans or even Canadian basketball fans. This is big. And we know streetball culture is still, you know, big around the world. You know, Joey from the doc is out in Asia at times. It's big in China. But why do you think this doc and this story is resonating with people so much?
I think there's a bunch of reasons. I think first and foremost, you know, we can't take any credit for the kind of 10 core guys of this crew. Just have like, and I hope you guys would agree with this, they have this like special charisma about them. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, I feel like if you got 10 of your high school friends together after 20 years, there'd be some like bad eggs and people you probably wouldn't want to talk to, and you certainly wouldn't want to put a camera on. And we got these guys together and they're just like amazing storytellers. And I think that resonates with people. And I think part of that has to do with they kind of grew up in this hotbed of like basketball storytelling and basketball as art. So I think that helps. And then I think a big part of it's an immigrant story, mm-hmm. especially I think in Canada, I think everybody is an immigrant and everybody can relate to that to some degree. I think going into it, we thought it was going to be like a hurrah of like, look how cool these guys are and look how special some of this basketball is. And some of the stuff's never been kind of done before or since. But then when we start filming, people start crying, people start breaking down what's happened in their lives before or since for better and worse. And you're like, oh man, this kind of movie ends up being sort of about a family, like an effed up family. And maybe that's sort of a story that everybody can get behind. And then last but not least, I think like, there's a story, maybe a subplot of the story that involves me and Kirk, the co-director, a little bit more. It's like a story a little bit about a reckoning of race and privilege and, you know, who gets to tell these stories. And I think that is interesting and hopefully gives it another level that makes people want to watch it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I would say, if you have a serious question, because you said something that you teased something to me.
Question,
okay,
ahead.
No, you please. Go ahead. I'll come back to the other stuff, because I'm just like, I'm watching the clips and I want to.
Yeah.
No, I go ahead.
What's really beautiful about this, because, you know, especially for the two of us, like we're so locked in on the Raptors. It's like the Raptors show. Although today we have not talked anything Raptors. But hey, listen, like, what do you want from us, man? Like, no one is trying to hear Raptors right now. But there is so much outside of that specific narrow lane. And that's not to diminish anything the Raptors do. Obviously, we love it. You got a poster of Colin DeMar behind you. So, you know what I mean? Like, I obviously know that this is a passion for you. But, like, ultimately, there are so many different ways that you can take basketball. And this is one of the things where every time I tap in, and again, I missed out on the hype of it, and, you know, the fashion, the culture, the significance, and that's why I'm so eager to dive into this. But there are so many other ways to engage with the sport of basketball and the ways that it can kind of create and connect community. And anytime I see that, it's beautiful. You know what I mean? And I could clearly tell that there is so much passion and so much history and so much significance and so much energy around it, too. Because, like, NBA basketball
is just
one thing.
Look at those crowds in those clips,
yeah,
too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, Raptors crowd's not looking like that these days. Sorry, unless they hand out a
sorry,
free
guys.
Adidas shoes. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, man. So, okay, Jeremy, you mentioned some of these moves, like some of the things that the players are actually doing. You kind of teased something in me to me over text. So you were involved in one of the moves from Goosebumps that doesn't make the doc. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Like, were you getting used as a prop? Like, you're the guy he first hits this move on, and you your ankles get broken. What are we talking about here?
There's a bit of that, but none of that is documented. There are people who look suspiciously like me getting just clowned up. It's not me on the record in the Nautic too. Uh-huh. But there's so Goosebumps has a book of moves. If you see the movie, you'll know what I'm talking about. And the way he writes about the moves is hysterical and lovely. And he a bunch of these come to fruition in ways you wouldn't believe. But one of the moves it's in the mixtape. It's just not in the documentary. It's called the Two Ball Fool. And I always think of this as like, you know, guys were putting the ball in their shirt. They're putting it around heads. I think this was like the max street ball creativity. And any further than this, and possibly even this, you're jumping the shark. So the Two Ball Fool is a move. Kirk and I went with Goosebumps to Zeller's trying to find a mini basketball, but that looked like a normal basketball, like orange, which is hard to find sometimes. And helped him, you know, that didn't help him buy it, but we're like filming him buying it at the cashier. He's like, this is perfect. This is the era. And then we used to go to these courts, and the move was like Goosebumps does a move where he puts the ball in his shirt and he pops it out and he tries to do a crossover, but he's purposely losing the ball as he does it so that the next time he does it, he puts the ball in his shirt. When it pops around, he can't quite get it around. This is like inside street ball. But anyways, the basketball is behind his shirt. And I, with the camera, the camcorder, walk up behind him, pull the big ball out, and slip the small ball in. So that when he taps the ball out, a smaller ball can come out. And the guy goes to reach because he knows, oh, I'm going to get this steal from what they set up in earlier losing the ball plays. And now he's holding this tiny basketball. Goosebumps has the real big ball, and he goes off and scores. And you can imagine the, like, difficulty and complexity of doing this. And also, no matter, like, these guys had a good reputation in the city, people were excited to play them, but like, if you do that move and it doesn't work and like this little ball dribbles out, we would just leave.
You're
like,
doing the middle of a Coyote Roadrunner basketball moves,
exactly,
basically.
Like an Acme anvil got balls on him and we dunk it. And so like, we would go do this, the mixtape's done, but we just want to get this one move on tape. We would go to different courts and do this in a pickup game, and if it didn't work, we would just go home. Like, we would just pack up in the middle of the game and just keep trying it until we finally landed it. And then we're just like, you know, tears of joy going like, okay, the mixtape is done. So yeah, just, and again, like, you can't go past that. That's the max.
We only got a minute left with you here. Music is a big part of this as well, right? The street ball is, you know, connecting with basketball culture the same, in a similar way at a similar time as hip hop did. The documentary is scored incredibly well. Music's a huge part of the documentary. And RZA is an EP. So I got to ask, like, did you get to meet RZA? Like, are you unofficially in the Wu-Tang Clan at this point? Like, what was RZA's involvement?
So I didn't get to meet RZA, but I think I am unofficially in the Wu-Tang Clan.
Okay, great.
That works. But
Chris Paul, Shea, yeah. Lou Dort, they're all EPs on this as well, right?
Yeah, Chris Paul came on first, and then he was like, hey, I have some friends in Oklahoma, from OKC that are Canadian basketball guys. Why don't they come on? And we're just like, what? How is this happening? So yeah, all those guys come on and really repped it. The music in it, I got to shout out Amir Says Nothing, a bunch of the best hip-hop in it. Yeah, really, really proud of the music in the movie.
Awesome. Well, in addition, so one other thing we wanted to mention is that King Handles, who's a figure in the documentary, has his School of Handles basketball camps out in Vancouver. And from scanning the Instagram and stuff, it's like, hey, keep this part of the culture alive and inject it into actual basketball or traditional basketball a little bit too. So people can check out King Handles School of Handles basketball camps as well. This documentary is Handled with Care, The Legend of the Nautic Streetball Crew. You are Jeremy Shaolin Ryu. Thanks so much for taking the time, man.
Hey, appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Of course. Thank you.
All right. Jeremy Shaolin Ryu, Handle with Care. It's out on Apple TV, YouTube, pretty much anywhere you can get documentaries. It did the film festival tour. It's tremendous. And Jeremy and Kirk do a great job with it.
And it's just so creative, man. And I think, you know, for NBA basketball, we're so concerned with, like, how do we get from point A to point B, being like, how do we compete at the very highest level, get the most results? We're playing this, like, super strict basketball where it's like, you go to the park and the playground, like, people aren't just, like, camped out in the corners ready to space out. You know what I mean? Like, people are trying to, like, pull off moves.
Yeah.
And there's an element of creativity, and it's like, you don't necessarily have to go from point A to point B. It's almost like, in a way, like skateboarding in a way, like, you know, how many points can you get for tricks? And, like, that's, for me, is like, it's the same sport, but it's, at the same time, you're doing it in a much more beautiful way. It's almost like wrestling versus, like, pro wrestling. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, no one watches like serious wrestling unless it's at the Olympics or something.
Yeah, I'm
but
ready.
Like, people love pro wrestling. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so anyway,
no, it's great.
It's just great to see the whole community around us. So congrats to Jeremy and his whole crew.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jeremy's the best as well. Like, he directs a bunch of music videos. Mm-hmm. He's directed feature stuff. He's, like, been nominated for Junos multiple times. The music, he directed me in the Pup music video that I was in.
We know why this happened.
If we had more time, I was going to get him to share just how terrific an actor I am, etc. But it is time now for Between the Lines, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Take a chance. The Raptors hosting the Lakers. They are 12-point underdogs. The over-under is at 232.5. Gary Trent will sit out tonight for rest. RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley are both probable to make their returns. Everyone else who's been out, including Ochai, remain out. On the Lakers side, Gabe Vincent, Christian Wood, Jared Vanderbilt, Cam Reddish, Jalen Hood-Sofino, all out, and LeBron and AD are questionable. Despite all that, Lakers have won 6 of 7.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we just had that conversation with Dan Wyke about this, but I do kind of expect them to play. I mean, if at all possible, they still need to get these results, you know what I mean? And the Lakers are not just in the play-in, but it's, like, very important to know that, like, 9 is way better than being in 10. And 8 is way much better than being in 9, et cetera, et cetera, just based on how the play-in works. So the Lakers have lots of incentive. So I'm really hoping to see both of them take the court. And, I'm very happy to hear that RJ and Quickley are closer to being able to play. Hopefully we see them tonight. And if we do, then we'll actually have something to really talk about tomorrow on the show. But in the meantime, yeah, I don't think you could pick anything in favor of the Raptors when it comes to basketball.
Now, that was Between the Lines, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Take a chance. Yeah. Make sure you tune into once. If you tune out at halftime, tune in to Handle with Care. Go stream that with your second halftime instead.
There you go. Okay, that's it for us today. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptors Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup. It's time to get fired up. Thanks to our producer, Amit Mon, our board producer, Lance Kennedy, Jennifer Olnick, David Sis, Jeremy Anita, helping behind the scenes. Thanks to our guests today, Dan Wyke and Jeremy Shaolin Ryu. And we'll be back tomorrow.